Today from the Wings Archive.
The one idea I think the rest of the world took from American feminists was this notion that you can't have equity for women without a deep sex role debate.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. According to Sheila Tobias, the debate over sex roles was the most significant feature of U.S. feminism, but it's also the shoal that crashed the second wave.
We talk about two waves of feminism in the United States, and the first wave means the suffrage movement, which was broader than suffrage when it first began. It called for not yet equality, but at least rights of access for women. But in becoming larger and more popular, it also lost some of its radical cast. By the end, there were 2 million members of the American Women's Suffrage Association working for women's right to vote. And that vote was won in 1919. 1920 was approved by the state legislatures. Now, something like a National Women's Party and some feminist activists continued to work on equity issues through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, but without that enormous support that suffrage had had. And in their place of the equity feminists came social reformers who were active on behalf of children, child and maternal health and welfare, all sorts of other do-good kind of issues, not unimportant, but not directed really toward the betterment of women's status vis-a-vis men. And that really is what was missing when the second wave emerged. The battle to be equal to men, not just better off, or not just with the right to go to medical school, some few, actual equality with men, not just at the ballot box. And so the 60s, to outsiders not participating, it must have appeared as if some ideas were planted by an extraterrestrial being, because suddenly in 1967-8, the words patriarchy and sexism and values of the oppressor, all this language of the radical feminist movement, was suddenly there on everybody's tongues. And it had not been on anybody's tongues 4 or 5 years before. Where did it come from? The second wave had millions of supporters. Ms. Magazine alone had 500,000 subscribers. Now Organization, one of several main organizations, had 500,000 or more members. I personally attended meetings at Betty Friedan's apartment where there'd be women on the floor, young women under 25 in their blue jeans, and older women sitting primly on the couch, you know, with their legs crossed, their stockings, mothers with babies in from the suburbs, all but wearing their aprons, and all of them were not noticing the differences, but feeling the unanimity of their being female. So it was a very sudden movement that brought three strands together in a remarkable willingness to ally with one another. If you think about the women who were members of a President's Commission on the Status of Women that was initiated in 1961, they were odd upper class women who had accomplished something as individuals in a man's world. They were quite remarkable individuals, but they were over 40, over 50, and had almost nothing in common with the sort of women who read Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique. That's a second strand, who were housewives, overeducated, underutilized by society, suffering from a problem that had no name. Nothing in common with a lawyer from Little Rock who was selected by her governor to be a member of a commission. And certainly neither of those groups had anything in common, or would have said so in 1965, with the student left. The women in the student left who were anti-war, who were pro-civil rights and integration, on the ramparts of some of the universities they were taking over, who were sitting in at the Pentagon and sleeping in the public parks. Very, very different women in terms of lifestyle, in terms of background, in terms of politics, and yet they all flowed together. And that's the magic of the story, that feminism, with its emphasis on the commonality of all women, was able to drive a wedge between all women and all men, virtually, and to coalesce these very, very different groups. And the theory behind it that was, for all of us, new thinking was that gender united us more than all the other aspects of our lives divided us. And that held together for about 7 or 8 years, that belief that gender was the overarching variable in our lives, made us work with very different women for a long time. And when that ceased to work, when that ceased to be a belief we could all share, then some of the divisions occurred and the next phase of the story began.
In Sheila Tobias's 1997 book, Faces of Feminism, the next phase of the story of the second wave is the beginning of its end.
The book concludes with a distinction I make between movement with a small m, which I consider unstoppable, that is the distribution of individual women into all aspects of the economy. We have a Secretary of State, I didn't think I'd live long enough to see that happen, an Attorney General, we have 50 women now in Congress, my own college roommate has been a member of Congress for 10 years. That movement, I believe, is unstoppable. I think you get a point where there's a critical mass, even in the face of the sort of things that stopped women in the 20s and 30s, the Depression, a war, economic downturn. It seems to me impossible that women would retreat to the lower statuses they once held. But the movement with a capital M, that is the organization of more than a million women who would agree to battle for a certain group of issues in a certain priority, I think that has ceased to be. I mean, one simple reason is that you can't maintain the kind of energy and unanimity and effort that characterized the first 7 or 8 years of the second wave, say 1967 to 1975 or 6. You can't keep that going for 20 or 25 years. People get simply tired and divisions occur. But a more profound reason, I believe, is that the issues got more complex. And I divide the issues into first generation, second generation, and third generation. And I define the first generation issues, the first now Bill of Rights, the agenda, as issues of equity, equality, issues on which most Americans, once enlightened, would agree. Very hard in this country, however rabid you are, to stand up and say, I'm for unequal pay, for equal work. I mean, that's just really against the American grain. And so issues like equal pay for equal work, non-discrimination on the job, equal access to credit. If a group of women come in with a business plan that has merit, they should not be denied a business loan. The help wanted male, help wanted female distinctions in the newspaper. These looked hard to battle, and we worked hard, but the opposition kind of melted before us as we proceeded. ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, passed through the Congress in record time with record support because it appeared on the surface to be an equity issue. And I believe that Americans of most stripes believed that there really was no excuse for not giving people equal opportunity, equal shot. The second generation issues, which came more to the fore starting in 73 with abortion, and then in 74 and 5 with Title IX, which gave women access to sports, and slowly with a whole lot of other issues from rape to sexual harassment, in my analysis, start tapping a different set of feelings and political views in America. It's no longer equity. And people who don't understand this intellectually feel it emotionally. We're talking about role interchangeability. Once you encourage women to build up their bodies and do athletics and go for the jugular and be a member of a team and kill, you are threatening age-old traditional notions of what is feminine and what is masculine. Once you give women control over their reproduction, the next stage is control over their sexuality. And in most of human history, societies have been at pains to keep women from controlling their sexuality. So sure, abortion was a religious issue with arguments on both sides that I respect, but just beneath it was a very deep-seated fear that once women could control their reproduction, the whole fabric on which family structure rested would be torn, and indeed that was part of the plot, because for a lot of us feminists, particularly the radical younger feminists, there was no question that simply maintaining separate and non-overlapping roles was not going to be the goal. We were second wave feminists. It wasn't suffrage, it wasn't opportunity practice law that we were after. It was a real sex role debate. And in fact, as I've traveled around the world and been in touch through reading with feminist issues and feminist groups around the world, it seems to me that that was the American contribution, except maybe for the French feminists. We were the ones who put the sexual debate right up front on our agenda, certainly during the second decade. Elsewhere, equal rights amendments, where they are equivalents, equal access to jobs, equal protections, daycare, abortion, such issues were legislated in favor of women very nicely, but they did not move into the realm that men consider their own. In other words, women's needs were well met by their movements and by their governments, but the challenge to men's definition of what men do as against what women do was never quite joined. So in Eastern Europe, for example, after the communists take over in the 40s and 50s, there were very fine laws on the books that protected women and gave women as mothers a great deal, longer maternity leaves, very fine daycare, often stipends for being mothers, which were not, we didn't have in the United States, but they never did raise the specter of role socialization and role exchange. And that's what we Americans did right up front. And that was very threatening to males and to more traditional females. But those issues came a little later, and people suddenly woke up and said, hey, I'm not as supportive of feminists as I thought I was, because they're challenging masculinity, femininity, and roles. Feminists never wavered, but a growing minority of Americans began to see problems, family values and the like. And those were the second generation issues, and they caused us a lot of loss of success. By 1975, we began to have opposition. And I think the opposition was sort of stunned and stunted in the period before.
According to Tobias, Phyllis Schlafly, an ultra-conservative Republican Catholic from Illinois, was the architect of opposition to the second wave. As early as 1972, Schlafly used her defense policy newsletter to call for stopping the Equal Rights Amendment. By 1975, she had a major national network of anti-feminist women.
The Schlafly argument is actually much more rational than we feminists wanted to see it at the time. She argues that for the women who are in her audiences who have few economic opportunities except marriage, because they marry young and they don't get trained, they are essentially one husband away from welfare. And if things conspire in our society to cause husbands to leave their families more easily, such as no-fault divorce, such as so-called women's liberation, such as the sexual revolution, which makes it easier to access women, they, these young and not so young mothers who have no other options, will lose, and they're going to lose big, because their entire status, their well-being, their sense of themselves, and their economics rests on the husband being present. So she had a very powerful argument for a group of women who had opted for the wife dependency role early on. And I listened to her tapes, I interviewed her in Alton, Illinois, and I saw the power of her argument, and that we women's liberationists, we feminists, weren't really able to meet her argument well enough at the time we needed to. And so she, in my opinion, almost single-handedly with the people she persuaded, prevented ERA from being ratified by three-quarters of the state legislatures and caused our country to have no Equal Rights Amendment, uniquely in the world. I think we made a few mistakes, and the most fundamental, and there may be disagreement on this, is we assumed that all women, once enlightened, would be feminists, and it turns out that's not the case at all, and that all men, no matter who they were or where they came from, would be our enemy. That was a simple-minded distinction we drew. Early on, it came from this marvelous, heady feeling about gender. Since gender united us, anybody who was not of our gender couldn't possibly understand us, right? But we were wrong on both counts. I believe, and I conclude this finally, that pro and anti-feminism splits America along the same political fault lines that everything else splits in America, namely liberal and conservative. Or progressive, if you prefer the word, and conservative. And that conservative men and conservative women equally are anti-feminist, and progressive men, if they can get over their fear of losing some privileges at home, but in their hearts, progressive men and progressive women, of course, are feminist. And that I made that mistake. I didn't see that for a very long time. In fact, until I went back and did this history from retrospect, did I see that more and more clearly, that this is another progressive conservative divide in American politics, which had the veneer of gender, you know, differences, but we were wrong. Some of the best friends of the feminist movement politically seen were the men in Congress who voted for our issues again and again. And we were kind of blinded to that, even as it was going on. We looked out and we didn't see the men, we saw the women, and we didn't notice the conservative women fuming in the background. And it was a political era, and I think it cost us ERA.
Sheila Tobias subdivides the second wave of the U.S. women's movement into generations of issues. The first generation issue was fairness. The second, the divisive sex role debate. And third generation issues would be still more divisive.
On the second set of issues, feminists never wavered, but a growing minority of people thought we'd gone too far. On third generation issues, as I sort them out, feminists disagree. And those are issues that are simply more complex. There are at least two points of views on surrogacy and on pornography, you know, whether you erase it from the face of the earth or whether you protect the First Amendment and live with it. On issues like comparable worth, whether you encourage increased payment for women doing female ghettoized jobs or whether you try to move them into non-traditional occupations. There are multiple points of view. Women in combat. I mean, there are many feminists who think that that isn't why we started the feminist movement, to put women in B-52s. I mean, that's very hostile to another long tradition of women in pacifism. But there are women who say if we're going to claim our rights as citizens, we're going to have to participate equally in the military. I participated in the military debate myself. So that would account for the loss of some of this unanimity. I mean, simply on these political issues, we don't agree. And it's perfectly understandable that we don't agree. But the most fundamental reason that we no longer have a single movement is the loss of the certainty that gender is the overriding variable. Over the last 15 years, it has come forth, and I believe it is the dominant view today among feminist women, that gender is but one of several variables that characterize us and account for our position and our work, and the others are race and class, and sexual preference, and ability, disability, experience in the family, whether it's abusive or not, and that these are as significant as gender. And once gender loses, or you could say lost, its power to explain us, gender loses its power to unite us. And that's why we don't have, in my view, movement of the sort I lived through that encompasses everybody.
In academic women's studies circles of the late 1990s, a popular line of thought is known as anti-essentialism. It decries the notion of a category of women that doesn't take differences among women into account. Sheila Tobias.
I spent two chapters dealing with feminist theory and scholarship because it was a very great contribution and it's very important. And of one of those chapters, I discuss divisions that have been very salient. And among the divisions I pick is the one you've just mentioned about essentialism. We believed, us who started it all in the 1960s, following Kate Millett, that differences between males and females, when not having to do with gestation and the simple biology of reproduction, were 99% learned through a socialization process that started in the family and was continued in the picture books children read, was continued in the movies we saw, advertisements that influenced us, and by our roles as adults. That was our firm belief, and that left to ourselves, without all this pressure to conform, we would probably be of interchangeable natures. I mean, there would be a great deal of individual difference, but maleness and femaleness would get kind of lost if we were left alone. That's what we believed. Sometime in the 70s, with the publication of In a Different Voice by Carol Gilligan, and a very interesting publication called Women's Ways of Knowing by four or five women educators, feminist educators, another view raised itself, namely that maybe there are essential differences in the beliefs, interests, and behavior of males and women, which are not learned, but are simply there. And it came from a very interesting source, from women who wanted to believe that women were different and even better, that there were certain characteristics of the female sex that are more nurturant, less aggressive, less warlike, kinder, gentler, and that we should not, in an effort to be more like men or to win the privileges of males, we should not lose the specialness, the special characteristics of females. And it was very appealing. I was teaching at the time. I would assign the Gilligan book to critique it, but my students would fall for it. They found a lot of resonance of their own feelings in her book. They know that they are looking for connectedness. They know that they care a lot about relationships, more even than males. And so when she laid out a view of females as essentially different from males, more sensitive, more relational, more contextual, kinder, they bought into that. They thought it was wonderful. I had my doubts then and now that, namely, we can make the claim that women will be excellent members of Congress, excellent Secretary of State, members of the Supreme Court, and at the same time argue that we are gentler and better. I mean, it seems to me Ruth Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor, who are members of the Supreme Court, have been approved for their legal acumen, for their training, for their absolute unbias, their ability to cut through complexity and see the justice issues involved. And if the world were to believe, along with Gilligan and others, that women are essentially more gentle and kinder and unlikely to approve a death penalty, you know, the objectivity of these professional women would be a challenge, would be, you know, less believable. So I saw this essentialism, this revival of the view that women are basically different from men in many ways. These differences are uncorrectable. These differences are true of all women and not true of all men. I saw them as politically very difficult and dangerous and threatening, and I wrote to that effect. The argument continues because the view is very appealing. I mean, if you're told by everything you've ever seen growing up that being female is a lesser status than being male, and then a group of thinkers come along who say to you, no, 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 being female is of greater value than being male, of course you'll find it appealing, but I think it's short-sighted. I think the only true emancipation and liberation of women will come when sex differences don't matter very much at all, not when we substitute one set of sex differences, the ones that make women look better, for another set of sex differences, the ones that make women look worse. To me, that is not moving forward, that's just exchanging some language. So I have a strong opinion about that.
One reason equality feminists like Tobias find essentialism heretical is that they're fighting a similar line of thought in the public at large.
I think it's widely held among Americans of most political stripes that women should have a fair share, that a woman who is able to do a job should do it, get the job, and get paid for it. But that wider population also believes as strongly that there's a special mother role or a special wife role, or that children need their mothers in ways that children don't need their fathers. So they're not as willing to consider role interchangeability, house husbands, or children being given as much time to spend with father as with mother. I mean, those things are considered a little bit far out. It also renders them nervous about sexuality. There's an assumption this is a slippery slope. And once you assign a male some house-related functions that are not traditionally male, something will occur that will render him less potent in the sexual act, because this is all a kind of closely knit fabric, and that raises hackles.
Tobias devotes a chapter in Faces of Feminism to the 1980s, when Presidents Reagan and Bush bashed feminists to please the religious right.
I really think the religious right has waned. I mean, its peak was and is no longer. I think Americans are very much more sophisticated. It took them only a year and a half to see through the Gingrich Revolution. And I'm not saying it's easy. It's never easy. But I think the long-term negative effect of Reagan and Bush wasn't to set back the feminist revolution so very much. It was rather to sour feminists themselves about mainstream politics. We had such hostility from mainstream politicians that I believe my sisters, more so than I stayed wedded to moving into the mainstream, but I think my sisters removed themselves back to the margin. We see that in the scholarship. The scholarship is becoming more and more esoteric. Scholars are talking more and more to themselves and less to the broader audience. We see that in the organizations with fewer members and more ideologically correct, you know, sort of locking out people who don't 100% agree. And I'm sorry about that, because I thought we were ready for the kind of cooperation and compromise that mainstreaming involves. But I'm very sympathetic, because those 12 years were brutal. And it's unfortunately came just at the time when many feminists were ready to join in. So I see a movement that is divided over issues and remarginalized because of a distaste for the mainstream. Better to stay outside and protest than to go inside and co-govern. And a loss of the kind of certainty and unique sense of our future, as a result of which I'm not sure there will be a third wave. I am attentive to some younger women's groups calling themselves the third wave. I tune into the girls' liberation chat rooms on the web. They're talking about AIDS as a major issue for their generation, anorexia, problems of weight reduction, issues of parental consent required in certain states for abortion. They're talking about poverty. They're talking about the treatment of runaways. They have a whole set of issues which were not our issues. And if you stand back and look at those issues, while they have political sides and implications, they're very personal. And it's interesting for me, because we were the group, the generation that declared the personal to be political. But our personal issues were, I think, a little more political than theirs. We're a small group led by some brilliant thinkers who managed to create a mass movement for maybe a brief while, long enough to think through what it would take to bring true equity. And the one idea, I think, that the rest of the world took from American feminists, I don't want to sound chauvinist about it, was this notion that you can't have equity for women without a deep going sex role debate. You can't just fix women's lives without impinging on and really altering men's lives. And we certainly saw that in the Soviet Union during all the years, that women had titular equality, equal access to the job, all women were working, there was daycare everywhere, abortion on demand, and those women would get off their jobs and start waiting on the queues for the food and do every bit of work in the home once they got back, and the men, nothing. That's not equity for women. And you don't get a change in those behaviors of men until you engage them and the whole country in a debate about sex roles. How useful are they? How necessary are they? How non-overlapping are they? Where do we learn our roles? How unchangeable are they? What will happen to males if they start doing more housework? All of that stuff comes with a sex role debate. And that's what our foremothers in the first wave didn't do. It was too early. I'm not blaming them. And that's what we feminists, thanks to Millett and Friedan and de Beauvoir, set out to do from the outset. And that's what made our movement different.
Sheila Tobias, author of Faces of Feminism, An Activist Reflections on the Women's Movement, published by Westview Press in 1997. Tobias also wrote Overcoming Math Anxiety and is co-author of Women, Militarism, and War. Reporting for Wings, I'm Frieda Worden.
Hear this archival program again at wingsradio.org or by emailing wings@wings.org. You may also like our news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the new book, The Maternal Roots of the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.